America, a land that had its beginning in the very dawn of creation. A land that is water, earth, and air. A land where the daring and courage of man has carved a giant country out of these ancient elements. A land both scarred and graced by the mark of man. Our heritage is here, in this land.
This land, a land where purple prose and swelling music roam free. A land from which was born, as if sprung from the skull of Athena, the Classical Classroom Podcast.
Dacia, let's just go with the regular open.
Sorry, I got carried away. Hello, this is your host, Dacia. That stirring audio clip was from a 1960s National Park Service educational film, which we played because the guest featured in this episode, Stephen Lias, has been a composer in residence at a number of our national parks here in the U.S., and he's going to talk about the intersection of nature and music and some of his adventures. By the way, did you know that it's the centennial anniversary of the National Park Service? True story. Have you seen these things? They're amazing. Happy birthday, National Park Service. Oh, and by the way, if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review us on iTunes because it pleases the National Park Service when you do. They did not say that, but I will just assume. Anyway, enjoy the episode. My name is Dacia Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Dacia Clay, and here with me today is composer Stephen Lias. His music has been performed widely, and he's also a professor at Stephen F. Austin State University, just down the road from Houston and Nacogdoches. He's recently become more focused on being an adventurer composer, which we're going to talk about today. He's an outdoorsman, and he's been composing a growing series of works about the United States national parks. He's done residencies in a number of those parks, including Glacier and Denali. He's recently been commissioned by the Boulder Philharmonic to write an original work about Rocky Mountain National Park. Stephen Lias, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, okay, it's the National Park Service's 100th anniversary, so this is a very timely episode. There's been lots of activity going on about that, like the Obamas just visited a couple of national parks for Father's Day. There's been all kinds of stuff in the news. So I'm interested in what led you to composing, to compose music about national parks. How did you go from what you were doing before, I guess, what were you doing before, and then how did you get to composing for national parks?
Sure. Well, obviously been a composer for quite a long time, so let's assume that the before involved composing. But also, I didn't discover my love for outdoor activities really until middle age. I was in my mid to late 30s, and I started just trying out kayaking and backpacking and things like that and discovered that I really took to it.
Yeah.
So I was doing those two things simultaneously without ever trying to combine them. And then in 2009, I applied for a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship, which I didn't get. But the idea of the application was the first time that I sat down and wrote in a proposal, I'd like to go to national parks, write music about those places. And when that proposal was not funded, I was a little disappointed initially, but it became obvious immediately to me that I didn't need a big boatload of money in order to go to a national park and start writing music about it. So that was the beginning of the project. And in 2009 and 2010, I started writing my first pieces. And I've been at it ever since. As you say, the timing was great because I started 5 or 6 years before the centennial.
Yeah.
And so it's been gaining momentum, and the National Park Service has become more and more interested and involved in what I'm doing as well.
That's awesome. So take us on an adventure. What was your first trip to a park that inspired you to compose music for it?
My wife and I had a trip planned to go kayaking down through Santa Elena Canyon at Big Bend National Park on the Rio Grande.
That's here in Texas.
Yes, it is. It's one of our home parks. And at the end of that trip, a trombonist friend, who happened to be the one that we were kayaking with, asked if I would write a piece of music for her, a sonata for trombone. And it ended up that I wrote it about our shared experience paddling through that canyon. So there are three movements to it. The first movement is about the excitement and anticipation of setting out. The second movement is a slow, somber movement about this part of the river called the doldrums, where you have to work very hard and stare at one mountain for a long time. And then the last movement is called Rock Slide, about the very dramatic set of rapids that you have to paddle through if you're going to go through Santa Elena Canyon. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a what we would call programmatic. In other words, it tells a story and tries to get the listeners to vicariously have a little bit of that experience that we had.
Sounds kind of like a tone poem, almost.
Yes, it is a lot like a tone poem. Tone poems tend to be a little more general in their goals. They'll capture a mood or a feeling. And I've written some pieces that are very much like that.
Yeah.
Whereas when we use the word programmatic, we generally mean a very specific description that the music is trying to portray.
Okay. We should hear some of that.
Sure. And actually, before he plays it, let me describe how I came up with the opening music, and then we can play the opening of the first movement of River Runner. I was writing this piece, and I knew that opening movement needed to capture the kinetic energy, sort of the adrenaline and anticipation, but also the frustration. You're setting out on an adventure, and you're all ready to go, but all the gear won't fit in the boat, or you've left something in the car, or you don't have enough of this or that, or they, you know, you don't have enough bungee cords. So there's always frustration and excitement, and I wanted to alternate between those things. So I knew the piano would have some sort of kind of energetic. And I didn't know what to do with the trombone. Uh-huh. And I was stumped on this for days. And finally, I was driving home one day, I just said, well, I'm going to say out loud to myself what it is I'm trying to portray in the music. What were we doing? Well, we were getting all the gear out of the car and throwing it on the ground. Getting all the gear out of the car, throwing it on the ground. Getting all the gear out of the car, throwing it on the ground.
That's great.
Literally, the music for the whole first movement came out of that idea, and I ended up writing lyrics for a trombone sonata, mind you. No one knows the lyrics but me and the trombonist. but I wrote these lyrics and then set it to music almost like it was a Broadway musical. And it worked out very well. Occasionally, we perform the piece with the lyrics so the audience can see them. But most of the time, we do it without.
Nice.
So as your listeners are hearing the opening of the first movement of River Runner, which is called Lajitas, they'll hear that boo-ba-da-ba-doo-ba-ba-ba-doo-ba-ba-doo-ba-ba-doo.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah. Awesome. So this would be Deb Scott, amazing kayaker and pretty good trombonist as well, and pianist Ron Petty. And then it switches to this more lyrical, anticipatory feel.
You may have already addressed this. Is the instrument the instruments that are used for this piece, is it entirely piano and trombone?
Yes. Generally, if we use the word sonata for something, and this is a trombone sonata, that generally means some instrument with piano. Not exclusively so.
I did not know that.
Yep. Generally, awesome. That is the case. And so if you hear someone refer to a violin sonata, they're probably talking about a piece for violin and piano.
Oh, that's one of those words I've never thought to ask what it actually means.
Right. Yeah. Well, the original meaning of the word had to do with touching, with actually touching the keys of the instrument, or sonorous is another word that has the same root as sonata.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it generally means a work for some instrument and piano. And then also, it has the added connotation of it's usually in multiple movements, so multiple sections. And this one has three. Most sonatas have three. There are some that have four.
I see. Do the instruments, and this is a little bit of a departure from what we're talking about, but do the instruments in a sonata, do they ever change? Like, for example, could you have written this sonata in three parts and had the piano and, like, trombone, then piano and sax, and then piano and something else?
That's a great idea. I would love to do that on a piece, but probably no one would call it a sonata. Although someone might. Nowadays, one of the things about the time we live in now is that many boundaries are breaking down, and there's a certain attraction for composers or artists of any sort to give something a name that we think has one meaning, but then we sort of reinvent it in a new form.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there are sonatas that do exactly what you suggest. The trumpet sonata that I wrote about Rocky Mountain National Park back in 2011 has one movement that asks the trumpet player to play a flugelhorn instead. So it's the same performer, but a different instrument.
Yeah, okay, so gotcha.
It's a little bit of what you were suggesting.
I'm curious, and I want to hear some more music, but I'm just curious about your creative process. When you go to parks, I know you said you just kind of, independently of your composing music, you got interested in going to the great outdoors and doing all kinds of adventure-y things, which sounds amazing, by the way. But when you kind of made that connection and you were like, oh, I should write music about these experiences that I'm having about these places. Are you just going with your eyes open while you're there? Or are you trying to sort of engender this creative inspiration? Are you trying to make that happen? How does it work for you?
It's different every time. And there's no either or. It's only and.
Okay.
And so certainly my method is to go to a place, learn all I can about it, and experience it in a very immersive way.
Yeah.
I want to get dirty if it's that kind of place, or if it's a historical park, I want to really dig into the history there, either the cultural history or the human history. We have national parks that celebrate many things. And so I want to let that park become my friend, get me to know it very well, and then let that guide what sort of musical process comes next. Sometimes I know going into a project what the instruments I have to write are for. For example, my upcoming commission from the Boulder Philharmonic about Rocky Mountain National Park has to be for orchestra. So that's not a decision that I get to make while I'm there. Other times I'm in the park and I don't even know what instruments I'll be writing for. So the experience I have helps shape that.
I see.
The beauty of it for me is that these parks, whether you are inspired by geology or wildlife or scenery or human history or heroism or tragedy, almost anything that can inspire music or art or opera or drama can be found in the National Park Service somewhere.
Yeah.
And so it's an unending sort of source of inspiration for me. I know that however long people keep wanting me to write music about national parks, I'll never run out of things to write about. I've got a piece about a search and rescue incident that happened in Mount Rainier. I just finished a string quartet about the famous American sculptor Augustus St. Gaudens. I've written pieces about mountains and bears and kayaking and backpacking. So it just differs from place to place, what that park reveals to me and then how that becomes expressed through music.
So your first time to sort of meld these two loves in your life came at Big Bend.
Mm-hmm.
Take us to another adventure after that. That sounds so cheesy, but please do.
No, that's great. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. In 2014, I was the artist in residence at Glacier National Park. And I should probably do an aside to explain artist in residence.
Yeah.
That's a term that some people won't know what it means. Many national parks have programs that they call their artist in residence program. And the concept is very simple. And that is that they have a juried selection process where they select one or a group of artists who are invited to come stay in the park for some specific amount of time. And their obligation is to make art about this place.
Wow.
And that serves the National Park Service's mission of reaching new audiences and having sort of an interpretive outreach to their park. So people will maybe go to a museum or a concert and experience vicariously a little bit of that park through that art that we create.
Yeah.
So I'm one of the only composers that's doing this. And so many of the parks that I've been to, I've been there as their artist in residence. And so I was in Glacier National Park in Montana as the artist in residence in 2014. And what became clear to me right away is that both the landscape and the human history there is really the sort of the old West we all romanticize and imagine with horses and guitars and steam locomotives and grand lodges and beautiful, beautiful scenery. So the piece of music that I decided to write was an orchestral piece, and I thought it should be rousing and inviting and very accessible in sort of the ways that the scores to great Western movies are. That was the spirit I wanted to evoke. And I thought I would write a piece that would serve as maybe a concert opener for a concert, something short and punchy that would leave you wanting more. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a piece called Crown of the Continent, which is a phrase people often use in reference to Glacier National Park. You referred earlier to the idea of a tone poem, and we talked about the difference between a tone poem and a programmatic piece.
Uh-huh.
This piece, I think, falls much more under the umbrella of tone poem. There's no moment in the piece where I'm trying to depict a specific mountain or a bear or a train, but all of those things sort of mixed up together create this feeling that the music evokes.
Okay, so, and is that like the distinct difference between programmatic music and tone poem, where programmatic music is telling a story? For example, I just heard the Romeo and Juliet. Tchaikovsky.
Romeo and Juliet's a great example of a programmatic piece. Certainly pieces like Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, even The Flight of the Bumblebee, although that's a very, very small program. It's something specific. It's a storyline that people understand. Don Quixote is another story that's been musicalized many times. So I wouldn't say it's a black line between the idea of program music and tone poem. But in general, sort of nuanced leaning, a tone poem tends to be more general, whereas program music, when we use that phrase, tends to be fairly specific.
Tone poem is sort of capturing the essence, the feeling.
Right.
Instead of, okay, I think I got it.
And it's very timely that we're talking about it today because it's officially coming out on a CD in about 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
From Navona Records.
Okay.
And we have a copy of it here today. We could listen to some of it.
Yeah, let's.
This is the Moravian Philharmonic. This has not been performed publicly in a concert yet, although we're hoping that it'll be programmed somewhere next year.
Totally has that Wild West sound to it.
Good. My work here is done.
I'm thinking of a piece it reminds me of. Is it Aaron Copland Very I'm good. Thinking about?
Sure. Now, I didn't set out to write a piece in the style of Aaron Copland, but
he's got that sound.
I did set out to write a piece that captured horses and mountains and trains and influenced by country fiddling and guitar playing. Once you make those decisions, you're making some of the same decisions that Aaron Copland made.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there's certainly a sense in this music that it's based on some of the same things that Aaron Copland's music is based on.
A nod, like, of that, to that flavor, sort of.
Right.
Yeah. Very cinematic sounding.
Well, the landscape there is cinematic.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've been to Glacier National Park, many of your listeners will know what that looks like. You just look at it and you hear a film score in your head.
Yeah. So, this music makes me want to ask, what is the craziest adventure that you've had at one of these parks? I mean, you've visited tons of them. I think I read that you've done 12 compositions so far?
Yes, actually 13 are completed. As of last week, I just finished the string quartet about St. Gaudens National Historic Site. Uh-huh. And so what's the craziest adventure? Well, I can tell you what the most strenuous and extreme one was. In 2012, I was selected as the artist in residence at Gates of the Arctic National Park.
Where is that?
Gates of the Arctic is up in the Arctic Circle. It's in central Alaska, so it's not, people immediately would envision, you know, icebergs and polar bears.
Yeah.
It's not that far north.
Okay.
But it's above the Arctic Circle. It's this vast, spectacular, mountainous area of sort of endless tundra and mountains and rivers and caribou. And so they only select one artist in residence a year. And this is a park that you can't walk into or drive into. You can only fly into.
Whoa.
And so their residency consists of you go on a backcountry patrol with a ranger. And since I had some backpacking experience, they decided that our goal would be to migrate with the caribou for 10 days.
Whoa.
So they flew us in to a remote sort of alpine lake up there in the Brooks Range, and we backpacked for a week and a half and saw thousands of caribou and lots of bears, and I carried a heavier pack on my back than I think I ever will again. And it was one of the sort of pivotal moments in my life where I discovered I was capable of things I had never done before.
Yeah.
I put myself very far out of my comfort zone and ended up writing a 12-minute long orchestral piece that was premiered by the Boulder Philharmonic and now has been subsequently performed by a number of other symphonies as well.
We should hear some of that. This is fantastic because, you know, right now in Houston, it is summer and it is just gross outside.
Right.
It's nasty and hot and humid. So this is great, getting to travel vicariously through your music. So have you ever been like chased by a bear or had to like burn your own clothes for warmth or anything weird like that?
Well, no, I'm very fortunate that although I like to put myself out of my comfort zone, I don't take a lot of risks.
Yeah.
And so I've seen lots and lots of bears. I've never been charged by one, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
But I've seen plenty of them and have grown a little more comfortable with how to behave. In fact, within the week, I'll be leaving for Alaska. I go there every summer. And now I lead a workshop called Composing in the Wilderness that is offered by Alaska Geographic and the Fairbanks Summer Arts Festival.
Wow.
So I'm now in the position where I'm training other composers in how to behave around bears.
This is so cool. You've kind of carved out like a whole new niche. When I first read adventurer composer, I was like, what does that even mean? Now
exactly.
I get it. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. I mean, this seems like a dumb question because when I think about the national parks, I mean, they're just unbelievable. They're grand. You stand in them and you're just like, this is the most incredible place mm-hmm. on earth. How does this even exist? But what makes this work important to you? Bringing the national parks to life through music. Why is that important to you?
Yeah, that's a nuanced question with lots of possible answers. I would say the first reason is very simple. And maybe a little disappointing because the question is very grandiose. But the first very practical reason is all artists are going to draw on whatever inspires them to make art.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the most basic reason is I'm trying to make good art. I'm trying to make music that will stand, you know, that will be worthy of the concert hall.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to do that, I have to draw on the things that inspire me the most. And as it happens, national parks inspire me. So that's a very practical reason. And as I said earlier, the depth of the inspiration that I find there is unending.
Yeah.
There's another interesting angle on this, though, and that is that the national parks and classical music share some common goals that people don't often think about. And that is that they are both underfunded. They are both worried about their clientele perhaps aging and not being broad enough and not being young enough.
Mm-hmm.
They are worried about the security of their and sustainability of their futures. And so those common goals actually make it kind of a nice match because as I'm writing music about a park, I'm doing missionary work for the Park Service.
Yeah.
But I'm frankly also bringing people into the concert hall who might not be interested in music by a living composer, but they are going to come to this because it's about Grand Canyon or Yosemite or Big Bend, and that'll attract them into the concert hall. And so I'm doing missionary work for contemporary music as well.
Yeah, that's amazing to think about that those shared concerns that the parks and classical music and frankly so many of our important institutions have right now. Libraries spring to mind.
Yeah.
You know.
And probably the third answer I should give is that there are a lot of conversations going on right now as we're speaking about funding for allocations for the division of authority for how public lands should be managed. And many artists take a very public position on where they fall on that spectrum. I don't necessarily. However, what I do think is that the people making those decisions should go see the places, go be connected with those places.
Yeah.
And that if we can have a public and an administration that are connected to these national places, then the decisions that they will be led to make will at least be informed decisions. And so part of why I love doing Composing in the Wilderness every summer is I get to take artists out into these places. And that's just my little tiny part of making more people deeply connected
mm-hmm.
with these natural wonders.
Yeah, actually taking them there and going, see?
Right. And frankly, it's also very fun to watch what the same experience will produce in 9 other composers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they all come to it with their own musical aesthetics, their own ideas, and their own personal viewpoint on that experience. And so they all write very, very different music, which
That's
is really thrilling.
Cool. Well, before we wrap up, we should hear one more piece of music. Where shall we travel to now?
Sure. Let's travel to Yosemite.
Okay.
A park that many, many people know. And in fact, many people know this park through the eyes of Ansel Adams.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of people who have never been to Yosemite know what it looks like because of these iconic photos of Ansel Adams that everybody's got in their dorm rooms and over their couches. And I was working with a good friend of mine, Nathan Nabb, who's a saxophonist who plays here with the Houston Symphony. And he challenged me to write a sonata for saxophone.
Uh-huh.
And he asked if it could be about a national park, but but let's do it through this other lens. And so we decided to do a four-movement saxophone sonata about Yosemite National Park, but instead of my experience there, to do it, to select four images of Ansel Adams and use each of those images as the inspiration for each of the four movements. So the four movements are Winter Sunrise, Vernal Falls, Jeffrey Pine, and Clearing Winter Storm.
We should also mention that you are a photographer, and if people go to your website, they can see some amazing photographs of these parks and of other things too.
Yeah, that's something that's gaining momentum as well. I started doing it to collect inspiration for my pieces so that when I go back to compose, I can surround myself with these photos. But more and more performances are being accompanied by projected image. Mm-hmm. And so I'm finding there's a lot of interest in performing my pieces with images, projected. That's what we've done with Gates of the Arctic and Glacier Bay and Denali.
Cool.
So, yeah, I've gotten more and more into the photography thing. And actually, right now, there's a photo exhibit of mine hanging at Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park.
Wow.
In Vermont.
That's super cool.
This movement is Vernal Falls. It's fairly programmatic in that I found a paragraph description that Ansel Adams had of a mountain stream and how it becomes larger and larger and starts hitting boulders and then eventually makes what he called the prodigious leap over the waterfall.
Yeah.
And so all of the music in this movement is designed to follow the life of a mountain stream as it grows and grows and becomes more violent and eventually goes hurling over a cliff.
Yeah.
Smooths out.
I like how the sax and the piano are kind of trading off.
Yep. There's a conversation going on between them, yeah.
I don't know if it's just the instrumentation, but it reminds me of some more like modern jazz that I've heard.
It's partially the instrumentation. It's hard to hear a saxophone
without thinking of jazz, This has to be really challenging to play.
It's blisteringly hard. This is the hardest single movement I've ever written. And this amazing performance with Nathan Nabb and James Pitts is a pleasure to listen to as a composer.
Well, Stephen Lias, thank you so much for coming in and doing this episode of Classical Classroom with me. It's been a real pleasure, and I feel like I've had like a little break from the horrible heat outside through your music, so thank you.
Well, I'm so honored to be here, and it's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
So you guys should go check out Stephen Lias's website if you can. It's got lots of awesome pictures and lots of information about what he's currently doing. That does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Follow us on all of the social media links that you'll find there on that page. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to us, rate us, and review us on iTunes, because it's awesome when you do. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Grand T. Todd Holslander for making us sound nice. Also, Mark DiClaudio seems to be on the board, so thanks to you too for that, I guess. Thanks to Mark DiClaudio for his piercing John Denver eyes. Thanks to Stephen Lias for making the trek to the station today. Thanks to Joshua Zinn for helping us coordinate this interview. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.